tend to view the European culture that used to rule them, and how many minority Americans view whites. It's the hostile stereotype of Asian Americans by white America, of Jews in Europe, of Indo-Pakistanis in East Africa, of Lebanese in West Africa, and of ethnic Chinese in Indonesia, and to a lesser extent, of rich people by poorer people everywhere. And it's the same derogation. They're cold, greedy, cleverly devious, clannish, don't assimilate, have loyalties elsewhere, but dang, they sure know how to make money, and you probably should go to one who is a doctor if you have something serious. People tend toward consistent feelings evoked by each of the extremes. For high warmth, high competence, i.e. us, there's pride. Low warmth, high competence, envy. High warmth, low competence, pity. Low warmth, low competence, disgust. Stick someone in a brain scanner, show them pictures of low warmth, low competence people, and there's activation of the amygdala and insula, but not of the fusiform face area or the emotional VMPFC, a profile evoked by viewing disgusting objects. Although, once again, this pattern shifts if you get subjects to individuate, asking them to think about what food this homeless person likes, rather than anything they can find in garbage cans. In contrast, viewing low warmth, high competence, or high warmth, low competence individuals activates the VMPFC. The places between the extremes evoke their own characteristic responses. Individuals who evoke a reaction between pity and pride evoke a desire to help them. Floating between pity and disgust is a desire to exclude and demean. Between pride and envy is a desire to associate, to derive benefits from. And between envy and disgust are our most hostile urges to attack. What fascinates me is when someone's categorization changes. The most straightforward ones concern shifts from high warmth, high competence, HH status. HH to HL. This is watching a parent decline into dementia, a situation evoking extremes of poignant protectiveness. HH to LH. This is the business partner who turns out to have been embezzling for decades. Betrayal. And the rare transition from HH to LL. A buddy who made partner in your law firm, but then something happened, and now he's homeless. Disgust mingled with bafflement. What went wrong? Equally interesting are shifts from other categorizations. There's when you shift your perception of someone from HL to LL, the janitor, whom you condescendingly greet each day, turns out to think you're a jerk. Ingrate. There's the shift from LL to LH. When I was a kid in the 60s, the parochial American view of Japan was LL, the shadow of World War II generating dislike and contempt. Made in Japan was about cheap plastic gewgaws. And then, suddenly, made in Japan meant outcompeting American car and steel manufacturers. Whoa, a sense of alarm, of being caught napping at your post. Then there's the shift from LL to HL. This is when a homeless guy finds someone's wallet and does cartwheels to return it, and you realize that he's more decent than half your friends. Most interesting to me is the transition from LH status to LL, which invokes gloating, glee, schadenfreude. I remember a great example of this in the 1970s when Nigeria nationalized its oil industry, and there was the delusionally misplaced, it turns out, belief that this would usher in wealth and stability. I recall a Nigerian commentator crowing that within the decade, Nigeria would be sending foreign aid to its ex-colonial overlord, Great Britain, i.e. Brits would be shifting from LH to LL. The glee explains a feature of persecution of LH out groups, namely to first degrade and humiliate them to LL. During China's Cultural Revolution, resented elites were first paraded in dunce caps before being shipped to labor camps. Nazis eliminated the mentally ill, already LL, by unceremoniously murdering them. In contrast, pre-murder treatment of the LH Jews involved forcing them to wear degrading yellow armbands, to cut one another's beards, to scrub sidewalks with toothbrushes before jeering crowds. When Idi Amin expelled tens of thousands of LH Indo-Pakistani citizens from Uganda, he first invited his army to rob, beat, and rape them. Turning LH thems into LL thems accounts for some of the worst human savagery. These variations are sure more complicated than chimps associating rivals with spiders. One strange human domain is the phenomenon of developing a grudging respect, even a sense of camaraderie with an enemy. This is the world of the probably apocryphal mutual respect between opposing World War I flying aces. Ah, monsieur, if it were another time, I would delight in discussing aeronautics with you over some good wine. Baron, it is an honor that it is you who shoots me out of the sky. This one's easy to understand. These were knights, dueling to the gallant death, their usness being their shared mastery of the new art of aerial combat, soaring above the little people below. But surprisingly, the same is shown by combatants who, instead of soaring, were cannon fodder, faceless cogs in their nation's war machine. In the words of a British infantry grunt serving in the bloodbath of trench warfare in World War I, "At home, one abuses the enemy and draws insulting caricatures. How tired I am of grotesque Kaisers. Out here, one can respect a brave, skillful, and resourceful enemy. They have people they love at home. They too have to endure mud, rain, and steel. Whispers of usness with people trying to kill you." And then there is the even stranger world of differing feelings about the economic versus the cultural enemy, the relatively new enemy versus the ancient one, or the distant alien enemy versus the neighboring enemy whose minuscule differences have been inflated. These are the differing subjugations that the British Empire inflicted on the Irish next door versus on Australian Aborigines. Or Ho Chi Minh, rejecting the offer of Chinese troops on the ground during the Vietnam War, with a statement to the effect of, "The Americans will leave in a year or a decade, but the Chinese will stay for 1,000 years if we let them in." And what's most pertinent about Byzantine-Iranian geopolitics? The millennia-old Persian antipathy toward the Mesopotamians next door? The centuries-old Shiite conflicts with Sunnis? Or the decades-old Islamic hatred of the great Satan, the West? Footnote. As I write, the Shiite-Sunni dichotomy dominates, producing the profound incongruity of both Iranian and American forces battling ISIS fighters in Iraq. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. No discussion of the oddities of human us-theming is complete without the phenomenon of the self-hating, take your pick of the out-group, where out-group members buy into the negative stereotypes and develop favoritism for the in-group. This was shown by psychologists Kenneth and Mamie Clark in their famed doll studies begun in the 1940s. They demonstrated with shocking clarity that African-American children, along with white children, preferred to play with white dolls over black ones, ascribing more positive attributes, e.g. nice, pretty, to them. That this effect was most pronounced in black kids in segregated schools was cited in Brown versus Board of Education. Roughly 40-50% of African Americans, gays and lesbians, and women show automatic IAT biases in favor of whites, heterosexuals, and men, respectively. Some of my best friends. The honorable enemy phenomenon raises another domain of human peculiarity. Even if he could, no chimp would ever deny that the neighboring chimps remind him of spiders. None would feel bad about it, urge others to overcome that tendency, teach their children to never call one of those neighboring chimps a spider. None would proclaim that he can't distinguish between us chimps and them chimps. And these are all commonplace in progressive Western cultures. Young humans are like chimps. Six-year-olds not only prefer to be with kids like themselves, by whatever criteria, but readily say so. It isn't until around age 10 that kids learn that some feelings and thoughts about thems are expressed only at home, that communication about us-them is charged and contextual. Thus, there can be striking discrepancies in us-them relations between what people claim they believe and how they act. consider differences between election poll results and election results. This is shown experimentally as well. In one depressing study, subjects claimed they'd be very likely to proactively confront someone expressing racist views. Yet actual rates were far lower when they were unknowingly put in that position. Note, this is not to say that this reflected racist sentiments. Instead, it likely reflected social norm inhibitions being stronger than the subject's principles. Attempts to control and repress us-them antipathies have the frontal cortex written all over them. As we saw, a subliminal 50-millisecond exposure to the face of another can activate the amygdala. And if exposure is long enough for conscious detection, about 500 milliseconds or more, the initial amygdala activation is followed by PFC activation and amygdala damping. The more PFC activation, particularly of the cognitive DLPFC, the more amygdala silencing. It's the PFC regulating discomforting emotions. Behavioral data also implicate the frontal cortex. For example, for the same degree of implicit racial prejudice, as shown with the IAT, the bias is more likely to be expressed behaviorally in individuals with poor frontal executive control, as shown with an abstract cognitive task. Chapter 2 introduced the concept of cognitive load, where a taxing frontal executive task diminishes performance on a subsequent frontal task. This occurs with us-theming. White subjects do better on certain behavior tests when the tester is white as opposed to black. Subjects whose performance declines most dramatically in the latter scenario show the greatest DLPFC activation when viewing other race faces. The cognitive load generated by frontal executive control during interracial interactions can be modulated. If white subjects are told, "Most people are more prejudiced than they think they are," before taking the test with a black tester, performance plummets more than if they are told, "Most people perform worse on a frontal cortical cognitive test than they think they did." Moreover, if white subjects are primed with a command reeking of frontal regulation, "Avoid prejudice," during an interracial interaction, performance declines more than when they are told to have a positive intercultural exchange. A different type of executive control can occur in minority thems when dealing with individuals of the dominant culture. Be certain to interact with them in a positive manner to counter their assumed prejudice against you. In one startling study, African-American subjects were primed to think about either racial or age prejudice, followed by an interaction with someone white. When the prime was racial, subjects became more talkative, solicited the other person's opinion more, smiled more, and leaned forward more. The same didn't occur when subjects interacted with another African-American. Think about Chapter 3's African-American grad student intentionally whistling Vivaldi each evening on the way home. 2 points are worth making about these studies about executive control and interactions with thems. Frontal cortical activation during an interracial interaction could reflect A, being prejudiced and trying to hide it, B, being prejudiced and feeling bad about it, C, feeling no prejudice and working to communicate that, D, who knows what else. Activation merely implies that the interracial nature of the interaction is weighing on the subject, implicitly or otherwise, and prompting executive control. As per usual, subjects in these studies were mostly university students fulfilling some Psych 101 requirement. In other words, individuals of an age associated with openness to novelty, residing in a privileged place where us-them cultural and economic differences are less than in society at large, and where there is not only institutionalized celebration of diversity, but also some actual diversity, beyond the university's homepage, with the obligatory picture of smiling, conventionally good-looking students of all races and ethnicities peering in microscopes, plus, for good measure, a cheerleader type fawning over a nerdy guy in a wheelchair. That even this population demonstrates more implicit antipathy to thems than they like to admit is pretty depressing. Manipulating the extent of us-theming. What situations lessen or exacerbate us-theming? I define lessen as decreased antipathy toward thems and or decreased perception of the size or importance of contrasts between us and them. Here are some brief summaries, a warm-up for the final two chapters. The subterranean forces of cueing and priming. Subliminally flash a picture of a hostile and or aggressive face, and people are subsequently more likely to perceive a them as the same, an effect that does not occur in group. Prime subjects subliminally with negative stereotypes of thems, and you exacerbate theming. As noted in Chapter 3, amygdala activation in white subjects seeing black faces is increased if rap music is playing in the background and lessened if music associated with negative white stereotypes, heavy metal, is played instead. Moreover, implicit racial bias is lessened after subliminal exposure to counter-stereotypes, faces of popular celebrities of that race. Such priming can work within seconds to minutes and can persist. For example, the counter-stereotype effect lasted at least 24 hours. Priming can also be extraordinarily abstract and subtle. An example concerned differences in electroencephalographic EEG responses in the brain when looking at same versus different race faces. In the study, the other race response lessened if subjects unconsciously felt they were drawing the person toward them, if they were pulling a joystick toward themselves versus pushing it away at the time. Finally, priming is not equally effective at altering all domains of theming. It is easier to subliminally manipulate warmth than competence ratings. These can be powerful effects. And to be more than merely semantic, the malleability of automatic responses, e.g. of the amygdala, shows that automatic does not equal inevitable. The conscious cognitive level. Various overt strategies have been found to decrease implicit biases. A classic one is perspective taking, which enhances identification with them. For example, in a study concerning age bias, having subjects take the perspective of older individuals more effectively reduced bias than merely instructing subjects to inhibit stereotypical thoughts. Another is to consciously focus on counter-stereotypes. In one such study, automatic sexual biases were lessened more when men were instructed to imagine a strong woman with positive attributes than when they were instructed to attempt stereotype suppression. Another strategy is to make implicit biases explicit. Show people evidence of their automatic biases. More to come concerning these strategies. Changing the rank ordering of us-them categories. This refers to the multiple us-them dichotomies we carry and the ease of shifting their priority, shifting automatic categorizing by race to categorizing by shirt color or manipulating math performance by emphasizing either gender or ethnicity. Shifting which categorization is at the forefront isn't necessarily a great thing and may just constitute six of one, half a dozen of the other. For example, among European American men, a photograph of an Asian woman applying makeup makes gender automaticity stronger than ethnic automaticity, while a picture of her using chopsticks does the opposite. More effective than getting people to shift a them of one category into merely another type of them, of course, is to shift the them to being perceived as an us, emphasizing attributes in common. Which brings us to contact. In the 1950s, the psychologist Gordon Allport proposed contact theory. Inaccurate version. If you bring us's and them's together, say, teenagers from two hostile nations brought together in a summer camp, animosities disappear, similarities become more important than differences, and everyone becomes an us. More accurate version. Put us's and them's together under very narrow circumstances, and something sort of resembling that happens, but you can also blow it and worsen things. Some of those effective narrower circumstances, there are roughly equal numbers from each side, everyone's treated equally and unambiguously, contact is lengthy and on neutral benevolent territory, there are superordinate goals where everyone works together on a task they care about, say, the summer campers turning an overgrown meadow into a soccer field. Essentialism versus individuation. This harks back to two important earlier points. First, that thems tend to be viewed as homogeneous, simple, and having an unchangeable and negative essence. Second, that being forced to think of a them as an individual can make them seem more like an us. Decreasing essentialist thinking via individuation is a powerful tool. One elegant study showed this. White subjects were given a questionnaire assessing the extent of their acceptance of racial inequalities after being given one of two primes. The first bolstered essentialist thinking about race as invariant and homogeneous. Scientists pinpoint the genetic underpinnings of race. The other prime was anti-essentialist. Scientists reveal that race has no genetic basis. Being primed toward essentialism made subjects more accepting of racial inequalities. Hierarchy. Predictably, making hierarchies steeper, more consequential, or more overt, worsens theming. The need for justification fuels those on top to pour the stereotypes of, at best, high warmth, low competence, or worse, low warmth, low competence, onto the heads of those struggling at the bottom. And those on the bottom reciprocate with a simmering time bomb that is the perception of the ruling class as low warmth, high competence. Fisk has explored how those on top perceiving the underclass as high warmth, low competence can stabilize the status quo. The powerful feel self-congratulatory about their presumed benevolence, while the subordinated are placated by the sops of respect. Supporting this, across 37 countries, higher levels of income inequality correlate with more of the condescension of HL perceptions trickling down. Jost has explored this in a related way, examining how myths of no one has it all can reinforce the status quo. For example, the cultural trope of poor but happy, the poor are more carefree, more in touch with, and able to enjoy the simple things in life, and the myth of the rich as unhappy, stressed, and burdened with responsibility, think of miserable, miserly Scrooge and those warm, loving Cratchits, are great ways to keep things from changing. The trope of poor but honest, by throwing a sop of prestige to thems, is another great means of rationalizing the system. Individual differences in how people feel about hierarchy help explain variation in the extent of theming. This is shown in studies examining social dominance orientation, SDO, how much someone values prestige and power, and right-wing authoritarianism, RWA, how much someone values centralized authority, the rule of law, and convention. High SDO individuals show the greatest increases in automatic prejudices when feeling threatened, more acceptance of bias against low-status outgroups, if male, more tolerance of sexism. And as discussed, people high in SDO and or in RWA are less bothered by hostile humor about outgroups. Related to our all being part of multiple us-them dichotomies is our simultaneous membership in multiple hierarchies. No surprise, people emphasize the importance of the hierarchy in which they rank highest. Being captain of the company's weekend softball team takes on more significance than the lousy, lowly 9-to-5 job during the week. Particularly interesting are hierarchies that tend to map onto us-them categories. For example, when race and ethnicity overlap heavily with socioeconomic status. In those cases, those on top tend to emphasize the convergence of the hierarchies and the importance of assimilating the values of the core hierarchy. Why can't they all just call themselves Americans instead of ethnicity Americans? Interestingly, this is a local phenomenon. Whites tend to favor assimilationist, unitary adherence to national values, while African Americans favor more pluralism. However, the opposite occurs concerning campus life and policies among white and African American students at traditionally black universities. We can keep two contradictory things in our heads at the same time if that works to our benefit. Thus, in order to lessen the adverse effects of us-theming, a shopping list would include emphasizing individuation and shared attributes, perspective-taking, more benign dichotomies, lessening hierarchical differences, and bringing people together on equal terms with shared goals. All to be revisited. Conclusions. An analogy concerning health. Stress can be bad for you. We no longer die of smallpox or the plague, and instead die of stress-related diseases of lifestyle, like heart disease or diabetes, where damage slowly accumulates over time. It is understood how stress can cause or worsen disease or make you more vulnerable to other risk factors. Much of this is even understood on the molecular level. Stress can even cause your immune system to abnormally target hair follicles, causing your hair to turn gray. All true. Yet stress researchers do not aim to eliminate, to cure us of stress. It can't be done, and even if it could, we wouldn't want that. We love stress when it's the right kind. We call it stimulation. The analogy is obvious. From massive, breathtaking barbarity to countless pinpricks of microaggression, us versus them has produced oceans of pain. Yet our generic goal is not to cure us of us-them dichotomizing. It can't be done unless your amygdala is destroyed, in which case everyone seems like an us. But even if we could, we wouldn't want to eliminate us-theming. I'm a fairly solitary person. After all, I've spent a significant amount of my life studying a different species from my own, living alone in a tent in Africa. Yet some of the most exquisitely happy moments of my life have come from feeling like an us, feeling accepted and not alone, safe and understood, feeling part of something enveloping and larger than myself, filled with a sense of being on the right side and doing both well and good. There are even us-thems that I, egg-heady, meek, and amorphously pacifistic, would be willing to kill or die for. If we accept that there will always be sides, it's a non-trivial to-do list item to always be on the side of angels. Distrust essentialism. Keep in mind that what seems like rationality is often just rationalization, playing catch-up with subterranean forces that we never suspect. Focus on the larger, shared goals. Practice perspective-taking. Individuate. Recall the historical lessons of how often the truly malignant thems keep themselves hidden and make third parties the fall guy. And in the meantime, give the right of way to people driving cars with the "mean people suck" bumper sticker. And remind everyone that we're all in it together against Lord Voldemort and the House Slytherin. Chapter 12. Hierarchy, Obedience, and Resistance. At first glance, this chapter simply complements the previous one. Us-theming is about relations between groups and our automatic tendency to favor in-groups over out-groups. Similarly, hierarchies are about a type of relations within groups, our automatic tendency to favor people close in rank to us over those who are distant. Other themes repeat as well, the appearance of these tendencies early in life and in other species, and the intertwined cognitive and affective underpinnings. Moreover, us-them categorization and hierarchical position interact. In one study, subjects gave racial designations to pictures of racially ambiguous individuals. Those dressed in low-status attire were more likely to be categorized as black, high-status attire, white. Thus, among these American subjects, us-them dichotomizing by race and the hierarchy of socioeconomic status overlap. But as we'll see, hierarchy heads in different directions from us-theming and in uniquely human ways. Like other hierarchical species, we have alpha individuals, but unlike most others, we occasionally get to choose them. Moreover, they often are not merely highest ranking, but also lead, attempting to maximize this thing called the common good. For Furthermore, individuals vie for leadership with differing visions of how best to attain that common good, political ideologies. And finally, we express obedience both to an authority and to the idea of authority. The nature and varieties of hierarchies. For starters, a hierarchy is a ranking system that formalizes unequal access to limited resources, ranging from meat to that nebulous thing called prestige. We begin by examining hierarchies in other species, with a proviso that not all social species have hierarchies. The textbook 1960s picture of hierarchies in other species was straightforward. A group forms a stable, linear hierarchy where the alpha individual dominates everyone, the beta individual dominates everyone except the alpha, gamma everyone except alpha and beta, and so on. Hierarchies establish a status quo by ritualizing inequalities. Two baboons encounter something good, say a spot shaded from the sun. Without stable dominance relations, there's a potentially injurious fight. Likewise, over the figs in a fruiting tree an hour later, and for the chance to be groomed by someone after that, etc. Instead, fights rarely occur, and if a subordinate forgets his status, a threat yawn, a ritualistic display of canines, from the dominant male usually suffices. Footnote. My apologies for how baboon-centric the examples in the coming pages will be. It reflects my 30-plus years hanging around them. Why have ranking systems? The answer, circa 1960s, was Marlon Perkins' group selection, where a species benefits from a stable social system in which everyone knows their place. This view is fostered by the primatological belief that in a hierarchy, the alpha individual, i.e. the one who gets first dibs on anything good, was in some manner a leader who does something useful for the group. This was emphasized by the Harvard primatologist Irvin DeVore, who reported that among savanna baboons, the alpha male led the troop in each day's direction of foraging, led communal hunts, defended everyone against lions, disciplined the kids, changed the light bulbs, etc. This turned out to be nonsense. Alpha males don't know which direction to go, given that they transfer into troops as adolescents. No one follows them anyway. Instead, everyone follows the old females who do know. Hunts are disorganized free-for-alls, and an alpha male might face down a lion to protect a kid, if the kid is probably his own. Otherwise, he'd grab the safest spot. When viewed without Perkins' colored glasses, the benefits of hierarchy are individualistic. Interactions that proclaim the status quo obviously help the upper crust. Meanwhile, for subordinates, better to not get a shady spot than to not get it after receiving a canine slash. This is logical in a static, hereditary ranking system. In systems where ranks change, this caution must be balanced with occasionally challenging things, because the alpha male may be past his prime and getting by on bluff. This is a classic pecking order, a term derived from the hierarchical system of hens. Variations begin. A first concern is whether there's actually a hierarchy in the sense of gradations of rank. Instead, in some species, e.g. South American marmoset monkeys, there's the alpha and there's everyone else, with fairly equal relations. In species with gradations, there's the issue of what a rank actually means. If your rank is number 6 in a hierarchy, in your mind are numbers 1 through 5 interchangeable guys you'd better kowtow to, while 7 through infinity are undifferentiated peons? If so, it would be irrelevant to you if numbers 2 and 3 or numbers 9 and 10 were having tensions. Rank gradations would be in the eyes of the primatologist, not the primate. In reality, such primates think about gradations of rank. For example, a baboon typically interacts differently with, say, the guy one step above him in rank than the one 5 steps above. Furthermore, primates note gradations that don't directly concern them. Recall from Chapter 10 how researchers recorded vocalizations of individuals in a troop, splicing them to invent social scenarios. Play a recording of number 10 giving a dominance call and number 1 responding with a subordination call, and everyone pays attention. Whoa, Bill Gates just panhandled a homeless guy. This can be abstracted further, as shown with ravens, which are outrageously smart birds. As with baboons, vocalizations implying dominance reversals command more attention than does the status quo. Remarkably, this even occurs for reversals between birds in a neighboring flock. Ravens discern dominance relations just by listening and are interested in hierarchical gossip about a different group. Next is the issue of variation within and among species as to what life is like having a particular rank. Does being high-ranking merely mean that everyone keeps tabs on your mood or, at the other extreme, that no one else is getting enough calories to ovulate, lactate, or survive? How often do subordinates challenge dominant individuals? How readily do dominant individuals vent their frustrations on subordinates? How much do such subordinates have coping outlets, e.g., someone to groom with? Then there is the issue of how high rank is attained. In many cases, e.g., female baboons, as noted, rank is inherited, a system with kin selection written all over it. In contrast, in other species/sexes, male baboons, for example, ranks shift over time, changing as a function of fights, showdowns, and Shakespearean melodrama, where rising in the hierarchy is about brawn, sharp canines, and winning the right fight. Footnote. Implicit in this is the fact these males and females have separate hierarchies. In general, females of the highest-ranking family can push around the lowest quartile rankings of males, though males otherwise dominate females. Hurrah for clawing your way to the top for sweaty, zero-sum, muscular capitalism. But what about the more interesting issue of how high rank, once attained, is maintained? As we'll see, this has less to do with muscle than with social skills. This ushers in a key point. Social competence is challenging, and this is reflected in the brain. The British anthropologist Robin Dunbar has shown that across various taxa, e.g. birds, ungulates, or primates, the bigger the average size of the social group in the species, A, the larger the brain relative to total body size, and B, the larger the neocortex relative to total brain size. Dunbar's influential social brain hypothesis posits that increases in social complexity and the evolutionary expansion of the neocortex have been linked. This link also occurs within species. Among some primates, group size can vary tenfold, depending on the richness of the ecosystem. This was modeled in a fascinating neuroimaging study in which captive macaque monkeys were housed in different-sized groups. The bigger the group, the more thickening of the prefrontal cortex and the superior temporal gyrus, a cortical region involved in theory of mind, and the tighter the activity coupling between the two. Footnote. The correlation between neocortex size and group size across primate species probably reflects each trait influencing the other, i.e., co-evolution of the two traits. The neuroimaging study shows that a bigger social group can cause interesting parts of the brain to expand in ways having far more to do with the neural plasticity of Chapter 5 than with genes and evolution. Thus, primate social complexity and big brains go together. This is shown further by examining fission fusion species, where the size of the social group regularly changes dramatically. Baboons, for example, start and end the day in a large, coherent troop, whereas midday foraging occurs in small groups. As other examples, hyenas hunt in groups but scavenge individually, and wolves often do the opposite. Sociality is more complex in fission fusion species. You must remember if someone's rank differs when in a subgroup versus the entire group. Being away from someone all day makes it tempting to see if dominance relations have changed since breakfast. One study compared fission fusion primates, chimps, bonobos, orangutans, spider monkeys, and non-fission fusion, gorillas, capuchins, long-tailed macaques. Among these captive animals, fission fusion species were better at frontocortical tasks and had larger neocortices relative to total brain size. Studies of corvids, crows, ravens, magpies, jackdaws showed the same thing. Thus, rank and Hierarchy in other animals is anything but straightforward and varies considerably depending on the species, gender, and social group. Rank and hierarchy in humans. Human hierarchies resemble those of other species in many ways. For example, there's the distinction between stable and unstable hierarchies. Centuries of tsarist rule versus the first inning of the Russian Revolution. As we'll see, those situations evoke different patterns of brain activation. Group size also matters. Primate species with bigger social groups have larger cortices relative to the rest of the brain, with humans topping off both measures. If you graph the size of the neocortex against the average size of the social group across primate species, you get Dunbar's number, the predicted average group size in traditional human cultures. It's 150 people, and there's much evidence supporting that prediction. This also plays out in the Western world, where the larger the size of someone's social network, often calculated by the number of email/texting relationships, the larger the VMPFC, orbital PFC, and amygdala, and the better the person's theory of mind-related skills. Do these brain regions expand when someone has a larger social network, or do larger sizes of these regions predispose people toward forming larger networks? Naturally, some of both. As with other species, human quality of life also varies with the consequences of rank inequalities. There's a big difference between the powerful getting seated at a restaurant before you and the powerful getting to behead you if the fancy strikes them. Recall the study of 37 countries showing that the more income inequality, the more pre-adolescent bullying in schools. In other words, countries with more brutal socioeconomic hierarchies produce children who enforce their own hierarchies more brutally. Amid these cross-species similarities, there are unique things about humans, including the following. Membership in multiple hierarchies. We belong to multiple hierarchies and can have very different ranks in them. Footnote. An example of this that I found to be excruciatingly uncomfortable. I used to play in a regular pickup soccer game at Stanford. I was terrible, which was widely and tolerantly recognized by all. One of the best, most respected players was a Guatemalan guy who happened to be a janitor in my building. At soccer, he'd call me Robert, on the rare occasion when anything I did was relevant to play. And when he came to empty the garbage from my office and lab, no matter how much I tried to get him to stop, it would be Dr. Sapolsky. Naturally, this invites rationalization and system justification. Deciding why hierarchies where we flounder are crap and the one where we reign really counts. Implicit in being part of multiple hierarchies is their potential overlap. Consider socioeconomic status, which encompasses both local and global hierarchies. I'm doing great socioeconomically. My car's fancier than yours. I'm doing terribly. I'm not richer than Bill Gates. The specialization of some ranking systems. A high-ranking chimp is generally good at related things, but humans can dwell in incredibly specialized hierarchies. Example, there's a guy named Joey Chestnut who's a god in one subculture. He's the most successful competitive hot dog eater in history. However, whether Chestnut's gift generalizes to other domains is unclear. Internal standards. This is the circumstance of having internal standards independent of the outside world. As an example, winning or losing at a team sport generally increases or decreases, respectively, testosterone levels in men. But things are subtler than that. Testosterone more closely tracks winning through skill rather than luck, and also more closely tracks individual rather than team performance. Thus, as usual, we are just like other animals, but totally different. We now consider the biology of individual ranks. The view from the top, the view from the bottom. Detecting rank. Much as with our ability to detect thems, we're intensely interested in and adept at spotting rank differences. For example, 40 milliseconds is all we need to reliably distinguish between a dominant face, with direct gaze, and a subordinate one with averted gaze and lowered eyebrows. Status is also signaled in the body, albeit to a less accurate extent, dominance with an exposed torso with arms wide open, subordination with arms sheltering a bent torso, intent on invisibility. Again, we recognize those cues at automatic speeds. Human infants also recognize status differences, as shown in a truly clever study. Show an infant a computer screen displaying a big square and a little square. Each has eyes and a mouth. The two squares are at opposite ends of the screen and repeatedly move to the other side, passing each other in the process. Then show a version where the two bump into each other. Conflict. The squares bump repeatedly until one of them gives in by lying down, letting the other one pass. Toddlers look at the interaction longer when it's the big square that gives in rather than the little one. The first scenario is more interesting because it violates expectations. Hey, I thought big squares dominated little squares. Just like monkeys and corvids. But wait, this may just reflect folk physics, not attunement to hierarchy. Big things knock over little things, not the other way around. This confound was eliminated. First, the adversarial squares were not touching when one gave in. Second, the subordinating one would fall in the opposite direction from that predicted by physics. Rather than being knocked backward, it prostrates itself before the alpha square. Along with this expertise comes intense interest in hierarchy, as emphasized in Chapter 9. Gossip is mostly about the status of status. Are there any fallen mighty? Have the meek inherited anything lately? Regardless of which square wins, infants look longer at the conflict situation than when the squares peacefully glide past each other. This is logical self-interest. Knowing the hierarchical lay of the land helps you navigate it better. But there's more to that than just self-interest. Those monkeys and corvids not only pay attention when there are rank reversals in their group, they do the same when eavesdropping on the neighbors. Same with us. What's happening in our brains when we contemplate rank? Naturally, the prefrontal cortex weighs in. Frontal damage impairs skill at recognizing dominance relations, along with recognizing kinship, deception, or intimacy in faces. The VLPFC and DLPFC activate and become coupled when we figure out dominance relations or look at a dominant face, reflecting the combined affective and cognitive components to the process. These responses are most pronounced when considering someone of the opposite sex, which may reflect mating goals more than mere academic interest about hierarchy. Seeing a dominant face also activates the superior temporal gyrus, STG, with its role in theory of mind, and increases its coupling to the PFC. We're more interested in what dominant individuals are thinking. Moreover, individual social status neurons occur in the monkeys, and as noted in Chapter 2, contemplating an unstable hierarchy does all of the above, plus activates the amygdala, reflecting the unsettling effects of instability. Of course, though, none of this tells us what we are contemplating at these times. Your brain and your own status. Your own rank does logical things to your brain. In macaque monkeys, an increase in rank increases mesolimbic dopamine signaling. And back to that rhesus monkey study showing that being in a larger social group causes expansion and functional coupling of the STG and PFC. The study also showed that the higher the rank attained within each group, the greater the expansion and coupling. Consistent with that, a study of mice showed that higher-ranking animals had stronger excitatory inputs into the mouse equivalent of the cognitive DLPFC. I love these findings. As I said, in lots of social species, attaining high rank is about sharp teeth and good fighting skills. But maintaining the high rank is about social intelligence and impulse control. Knowing which provocations to ignore and which coalitions to form, understanding other individuals' actions. Does the monkey make history, or does history make the monkey? Once groups were formed, did individuals who became dominant respond with the biggest expansions of those brain regions? Or prior to group formation, Were the individuals destined to become dominant already endowed in those regions? Unfortunately, animals weren't imaged before and after group formation in the study. However, subsequent work showed that the larger the size of the group, the larger the association between dominance and those brain changes, suggesting that attaining high rank drives the enlargement. In contrast, the mouse study showed that when synaptic excitability was increased or decreased in the DLPFC, rank rose or declined respectively, suggesting that enlargement drives attainment of high rank. The brain can shape behavior, can shape the brain, can shape your body and your own status. What about biological differences outside the brain as a function of rank? For example, do high and low-ranking males differ in their testosterone profiles, and if there are differences, are they causes, consequences, or mere correlates of the rank differences? Folk endocrinology has always held that high rank in any species and elevated testosterone levels go hand in hand, with the latter powering the former. But as covered at length in Chapter 4, neither is the case in primates. As a reminder, in stable hierarchies, high-ranking males typically don't have the highest testosterone concentrations. Instead, it's usually low-ranking adolescent males starting fights they can't finish. When there is an association between high rank and high testosterone, it generally reflects the higher rates of sexual behavior among dominant individuals driving secretion. An exception to the above is during unstable times. For example, among a number of primate species, high-ranking males have the highest testosterone levels for the first months, but not years, after group formation. During unstable times, the high testosterone-high-rank relationship is more a consequence of the high rates of fighting among the high-ranking cohort than of rank itself. Reiterating the challenge hypothesis, the elevation in testosterone levels caused by fighting is not so much about aggression as about challenge. If status is maintained aggressively, testosterone fosters aggression. If status were maintained by writing beautiful, delicate haikus, testosterone would foster that. Next, we consider the relationship between rank and stress. Are different ranks associated with different levels of stress hormones, styles of coping, and incidences of stress-related disease? Is it more stressful to be dominant or subordinate? An extensive literature shows that a sense of control and predictability reduces stress. Yet monkey research conducted by Joseph Brady in 1958 produced a different view. Half the animals could press a bar to delay shocks, executive monkeys. The passive other half received a shock whenever the executive did, and the executive monkeys, with their control and predictability, were more likely to ulcerate. This birthed the executive stress syndrome. Those on top are burdened with the stressors of control, leadership, and responsibility. Executive stress syndrome became a meme. But a huge problem was that monkeys were not randomly assigned to be executives and non-executives. Instead, those that pressed the bar soonest in pilot studies were made executives. Such monkeys were subsequently shown to be more emotionally reactive. So Brady had inadvertently stacked the executive side with the ulcer-prone neurotics. So much for ulcerating executives. Contemporary studies show that the worst stress-related health typically occurs in middle management, with its killer combo of high work demands but little autonomy, responsibility without control. By the 1970s, dogma held that subordinate organisms are the most stressed and unhealthy. This was first shown with lab rodents, where subordinate animals typically had elevated resting levels of glucocorticoids. In other words, even in the absence of stress, they showed signs of chronically activating the stress response. The same is observed in primates ranging from rhesus monkeys to lemurs. Same for hamsters, guinea pigs, wolves, rabbits, and pigs. Even fish. Even sugar gliders, whatever they are. In a pair of unintentional studies of captive monkeys in which subordinate individuals were basically subordinated to death, such animals had extensive damage to the hippocampus, a brain region very sensitive to the damaging effects of glucocorticoid excess. My own work with baboons in Africa showed the same, being the first such studies of wild primates. In general, low-ranking male baboons had elevated basal glucocorticoid levels. When something stressful did occur, their glucocorticoid stress response was relatively sluggish. When the stressor was over, their levels returned to that elevated baseline more slowly. In other words, too much of the stuff in the bloodstream when you don't need it, and too little when you do. Remarkably, at the nuts and bolts level of brain, pituitary, and adrenals, the elevated basal glucocorticoid levels of a subordinate occurred for the same reasons as the elevated levels in humans with major depression. For a baboon, social subordination resembles the learned helplessness of depression. Excessive glucocorticoids get you into trouble in various ways, helping explain why chronic stress makes you sick. Subordinate baboons paid a price in other realms as well. They had A, elevated blood pressure and a sluggish cardiovascular response to a stressor, B, lower levels of good HDL cholesterol, C, subtle immune impairments, a higher frequency of getting sick and slower wound healing, D, a testicular system more easily disrupted by stress than that of dominant males, and E, lower circulating levels of a key growth factor. Try not to be a subordinate baboon. Chickens and eggs reappear. Does a particular physiological attribute contribute to rank, or the reverse? This is impossible to determine in wild animals, but in captive primate populations, the distinctive physiological features of a rank generally follow, rather than precede, the establishment of the rank. At that point, I'd happily proclaim that these findings reflected the nature of hierarchy with a capital H and of the stressfulness of social subordination, which turned out to be totally wrong. A first wrinkle was provided by Jean Altman of Princeton and Susan Alberts of Duke, studying wild baboons with stable hierarchies. They found the familiar picture, namely of subordination associated with elevated basal glucocorticoid levels. However, unexpectedly, levels in alphas were elevated into the range seen in lowest-ranking males. Why is life more stressful for alpha than beta males? The two ranks had similar rates of being challenged by lower-ranking males, a source of stress, and being groomed by females, a source of coping. However, alpha males fight more often and spend more time in sexual consortships with females, which is majorly stressful, as the male has to defend his consortship from harassing males. Ironically, a chief benefit of alphadom, sexual consortships, can be a major stressor. Be careful what you wish for. Okay, so except for the curse of being alpha, social subordination is generally stressful. But this is also wrong. It's not just the rank that matters, but what the rank means. Consider the primate species in which a relationship has been found between rank and glucocorticoid levels. Across these species, basal glucocorticoid levels are relatively elevated in subordinate animals if A. dominant individuals in bad moods frequently displace aggression onto subordinates, B. subordinates lack coping outlets, such as a grooming partner, and or C, the social structure is such that subordinate animals have no relatives present. And when the profile was the opposite, it was dominant animals with the highest glucocorticoid levels. The meaning of rank and its physiological correlates also vary between different groups of the same species. For example, while health of subordinate baboons fared particularly badly in a troop with high rates of dominant males displacing aggression, the health of dominant males fared badly in a troop during a period of instability centered around the top of the hierarchy. And superimposed on all this, personality shapes the perception of the reality of rank. Using the word personality about other species used to cost you tenure, but it's now a hot topic in primatology. Individuals in other species have stable differences in temperament. How likely someone is to displace aggression when frustrated, how socially affiliative they are, how rattled they get by novelty, and so on. Primates differ as to whether they see watering holes as half empty or full. In the context of hierarchy, some individuals who are number two care only that they're not number one, and some individuals who are number 9 gain comfort from at least not being number 10. Not surprisingly, personality influences the rank/health relationship. For the same high rank, an individual is likely to be less healthy if he A. is particularly reactive to novelty, B. sees threats in benign circumstances, e.g. his rival showing up and merely taking a nap nearby, C. doesn't take advantage of social control, e.g. letting a rival determine the start of an obvious showdown, D. doesn't differentiate between good and bad news, e.g. distinguishing behaviorally between winning and losing a fight, and or E. doesn't have social outlets when frustrated. You could make a living giving baboons how to succeed in business seminars built around these factors. Meanwhile, on the flip side, for the same low rank, an individual tends to be healthier if A. he has lots of grooming relationships, and or B. there's someone even lower ranking than him to serve as a target for displaced aggression. Thus, in other species, how does rank affect the body? It depends on what it's like to have a certain rank in that species and particular social group, and the personality traits that filter the perception of those variables. What about humans? And us. A smidgen of neurobiology research has examined differences in how people feel about hierarchy. Back to a concept from the last chapter. Social dominance orientation, SDO, the measure of how much people value power and prestige. In one study, subjects viewed someone in emotional pain. As reviewed in Chapter 2, this activates the anterior cingulate cortex and insular cortex, empathy, and disgust at the circumstance that evoked the pain. The higher someone's SDO score, the less activation of those two regions. Those with the most interest in prestige and power seem least likely to feel for those less fortunate. What about the biological correlates of a human having a particular rank? In some ways, we're more subtle than other primates. In others, far less so. Two studies examined high-status individuals in government or the military. In the latter case, officers up to the level of colonel. As compared with low-status controls, these folks had lower basal glucocorticoid levels, less self-reported anxiety, and an enhanced sense of control, this telling us nothing, however, as to which came first, the rank or the unstressed profile. Baboons redux. But something subtler was happening. The authors deconstructed high rank with three questions. A. How many people ranked lower than the subject in his organization? B. How much autonomy did he have, e.g. to hire and fire? C. How many people did he directly supervise? And high rank came with low glucocorticoids and anxiety only insofar as the position was about the first two variables. Lots of subordinates, lots of authority. In contrast, having to directly supervise lots of subordinates did not predict those good outcomes. This gives credence to executives bellyaching about how they aren't supervising 110 people. Instead, they have 110 bosses. To accrue the full physiological benefits of high status, don't supervise people. Instead, glide through the workplace like a master of the universe, while minions, whom you never interact with, smile obsequiously. It's not just rank, it's what rank means and entails. In what sense is the status/health relationship in humans less subtle than in other primates? In that it reflects the most permeating form of status any primate has invented. Namely, socioeconomic status, SES. Numerous studies examine the health/SES gradient, the fact that life expectancy and the incidence and morbidity of numerous diseases are worse in poor people. To summarize this sprawling topic that was reviewed in Chapter 9, which comes first, poverty or poor health? Overwhelmingly the former. Recall that developing in a low SES womb makes poorer health as an adult more likely. It's not that the poor have poor health and everyone else is equally healthy. For every step down the SES ladder, health is worse. The problem isn't that poor people have less healthcare access. The gradient occurs in countries with socialized medicine and universal healthcare, and for diseases whose incidence is independent of healthcare access. Only about a third of the variability is explained by the poor being exposed to more health risk factors, e.g. pollution, and fewer protective factors, e.g. health club memberships. The gradient seems to be about the psychological baggage of SES. A. Subjective SES predicts health at least as accurately as objective SES, meaning that it's not about being poor, it's about feeling poor. B. Independent of absolute levels of income, the more income inequality in a community, meaning the more frequently the poor have their noses rubbed in their low status, the steeper the health gradient. C. Lots of inequality in a community makes for low social capital, trust, and a sense of efficacy, and that's the most direct cause of the poor health. Collectively, these studies show that the psychological stress of low SES is what decreases health. Consistent with that, it is diseases that are most sensitive to stress, cardiovascular, gastrointestinal, and psychiatric disorders, that show the steepest SES/health gradients. The SES/health gradient is ubiquitous, regardless of gender, age, or race, with or without universal health care, in societies that are ethnically homogeneous and those rife with ethnic tensions, in societies in which the central mythology is a capitalist credo of living well is the best revenge, and those in which it is a socialist anthem of from each according to his ability.